Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com, and for the first time in I can't remember how many years, we are light on politics. So I don't know how to feel about that, but we're going to go with it. There's a lot from Hollywood. There's a lot of royal news. And so we're just going to see where the hour takes us. We're going to start with the royals. And we have royal moves. Kate Middleton and Prince William are moving to Windsor Great Park. The Prince and Princess of Wales will trade their cozy Adelaide cottage for the 8-bedroom Forest Lodge. This is by Eve Beattie on August 16th. 3 years after Kate Middleton and Prince William swapped their Kensington Palace residence for a main home on the Windsor Park Home Park estate, the family is moving again. Along with children Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis, the Prince and Princess of Wales will soon leave their current abode of Adelaide Cottage for the nearby Forest Lodge, located in the Windsor Great Park. The couple moved to Adelaide Cottage in 2022, motivated by a desire to escape the spotlight of Kensington Palace and to be closer to Queen Elizabeth's Windsor Castle home. William and Kate have been talking to their close friends about leaving Kensington Palace, where they feel very overlooked, a source told Vanity Fair nearly a year before the couple's move. It will remain their official London base, but they prefer being in the countryside, and the commute to London would be very easy. While the 4-bedroom cottage the couple settled on reportedly wasn't their dream home, it appeared to be the best option at the time. Finding a way to make Adelaide Cottage work seems to be the best and only option, a source said at the time of their move. There are issues with all the other houses, so Adelaide will be the favorite. But soon after the family started to unpack, things changed again. Queen Elizabeth died, just as Kate Middleton and Prince William landed in the dwelling. It was not exactly the settling-in period they had hoped for, a source said of that period in the Wales lives. Instead, that move preceded a few years of unexpected struggle. After the obligations of the Queen's funeral, the young family was thrust into preparations for the coronation of King Charles III. Less than a year later, the King went public with his diagnosis of cancer, while unbeknownst to the world, until a bombshell announcement in March 2024, Kate Middleton was also undergoing treatment for an undisclosed form of the disease. Middleton announced that she was officially in remission earlier this year, while the King's treatments are reportedly ongoing, both factors that likely impacted the Wales' latest decision to move. Less of a factor, it seems, is a recent security breach near their current home, nor a similar incursion the year before. Their home to be, the 328-year-old Forest Lodge, is currently undergoing minor renovations, the Independent reports, noting that the royal couple are understood to be paying for the move and renovations themselves, avoiding any extra cost to the taxpayer. According to planning applications filed in June with the Royal Borough of Windsor and Maidenhead, changes to the 8-bedroom structure include new doors and windows, stripping out internal walls, renovated ceilings, and new floors. The residence, which the King owns as part of the Crown Estate, was last renovated in 2001, records show, after which it was available to rent for £15,000 per month. The family plans to move into their new home in the near future, a Kensington Palace spokesperson confirms, saying the Wales family will move house later this year. Next in the royals is Princess Anne, the royal family's accidental style icon. The second daughter of Queen Elizabeth says she isn't interested in fashion, but fashion is certainly interested in her. This is by Georgia Olivieri, August 15th. Accidental style icon. That describes Princess Anne, the indefatigable royal who turns 75 on Friday, who has no intention of retiring to private life despite her age. At an official event attended by other royals, such as Kate Middleton and Duchess Sophie of Edinburgh, it's unlikely that the second-born daughter of Queen Elizabeth will make headlines for her look, but hers may be the most interesting of all. There is no special process around what she wears other than the directions prescribed by protocol. There are no stylists to select her outfits, and she has not created any association with luxury brands. Yet Princess Anne is undoubtedly a style icon, even if by accident. The reason? She's one of the few royals who dress with personality, and you either have that or you don't. There is no image consultant or brand who can make it for you. The Queen and I had a discussion the other day about the difference between fashion and style, and I think maybe that's relevant in the sense that she didn't do fashion, but she certainly does style, and style tends to last longer. You have an individual style, and it's a quality which has a long-term value, she said in 2022. On the occasion of the Platinum Jubilee, the Australian magazine Women's Day was granted not just an interview, but an opportunity to eavesdrop on a conversation between mother and daughter. The two women, for whatever reason, slipped into a conversation that led them to talk about clothes, illustrating their philosophy. Although Queen Elizabeth's style and Princess Anne's are very different, we could see a common matrix that prioritizes service over fashion trends. Comfort comes first for the workaholic of the royal family. Every year, the Princess Royal wins the title of the hardest working royal, with hundreds and hundreds of events attended. In 2024 alone, the year a horseback riding accident forced her out of work for several weeks, she nevertheless reached 474. So she needs clothes that are both practical and appropriate for the context in which she will have to operate. Between a helicopter or car transfer, a plane to catch, and dozens of people to meet, Anne needs to be sure that her clothes will not betray her. So wearing tried and true, field-tested outfits provides her with the crystal ball. She knows how they will react to spills, how they will look in photographs, and whether the sleeves are appropriate for shaking the hands of those she meets. Though re-wears are a well-established practice among royals who try to please detractors who do not want their tax dollars going into clothes, in Princess Anne we seem to detect a certain ill-concealed complacency in making headlines with looks several years old. With each outing, recent ones included, it's as if the royal confronts us with a riddle to be solved that sends royal fashion enthusiasts into jubilation. There was her 2025 Commonwealth Day outfit, the same one she wore in 2023. There was the outfit she broke out on the second day of Royal Ascot 2025, originally spotted on the balcony of Buckingham Palace in 1987. At the Royal Ascot in 2015, Princess Anne dusted off a yellow coat that had debuted a full 35 years earlier at Trooping the Colour. There is a white coat with blue inserts on the shoulders that has cyclically reappeared since 1980. In the portrait dedicated to her by the Daily Mail on the occasion of her birthday, some of her friends said that it is highly unlikely that Anne will buy a new dress for the wedding of her son, Peter Phillips, who announced his engagement to Harriet Spurling on August 1st. Princess Anne is a true style icon and was all about sustainable fashion before the rest of us really knew what that meant, said Edward Enninful, former editor of British Vogue, in a Vanity Fair article from 2020. She is timeless in her style, and she wears a tailored suit better than anyone else I can think of. Many of the newer garments, those not salvaged from the 1980s, were made by Shibumi, a tailor shop a quarter-hour drive from her Gatcombe Park estate. Among the pillars that hold up her style is supporting small business in her town. "I rarely buy anything that is not made in the UK," the royal said. She is the president of the UK Fashion and Textile Association, and on July 17, 2025, after 35 years with the organization, she received an honorary degree for services to the arts for that experience in the industry. "I still try and buy materials and have them made because I think that's more fun," she told Vanity Fair in 2020. "It also helps to support those who still manufacture in this country. We mustn't forget we've got those skills, and there are still places to do that, do a fantastic job. It's a position similar to the one held by her brother, King Charles, a great advocate of craftsmanship and sustainability in the fashion industry. There's always talk about the Kate effect, the Princess of Wales' magic touch of turning the garments she wears into coveted items, or Queen Elizabeth's signature colorful coats, but we tend to overlook the power of Anne's style. Between the 1960s and 1970s, she was the catalyst for newspaper attention to the point that she was featured on no fewer than 3 Vogue covers. She was one of the first royal women to show up at public engagements wearing pants, and even the hemlines of her feminine skirts followed the spirit of the times. As a young woman, she spotted irresistible outfits in her leisure time, looks that are not so different from what she wears in her country home while tending to her cattle and her horses. There are 2 specimens in the stable, by the way, that would make one rethink her opinion on fashion, since their name, Schiaparelli and Real Fashion. In the images from the past, Anne posed with her ex-husband, Mark Phillips, wearing layered outfits, jeans, denim skirts, headscarf, bucket hat, which she still wears, photos that look like they were taken today. But attention to Anne faded when Princess Diana arrived on the scene. It's hard to compete with that sister-in-law with the unquestionable flair for trends she often launched. Assuming that competing was not her priority, Princess Anne, in response, began to style her hair in a way she would never abandon. At the very moment it began to be considered untrendy, it became iconic. Even the younger generation took notice of her. They were enraptured by the way she wore her sunglasses. On that, too, she was able to anticipate trends, sporting aviator glasses or Oakleys well-suited for sports. Her favorites are undoubtedly the Team GB Adidas from the 2012 London Olympics. The exact origin of the accessory is unknown. Some claim that her daughter Zara Tyndall gave them to her when she represented her country at the equestrian discipline, or others speculate they were a gift from the cycling team. When she slips on those raver glasses to travel on behalf of His Majesty, or at events such as Royal Ascot, you can't help but love them. Princess Anne is the chicest woman in the world, declared Silvia Venturini Fendi when presenting the men's Fall-Winter 2024 collection at Milan Fashion Week. When I saw the coronation last year with Princess Anne in uniform, I thought she was beautiful. So I thought, let's get inspired for a men's collection. I liked the idea of breaking barriers, breaking male and female codes. The royal princess is very strict in the way she dresses, with this military-like attitude, but she's feminine at the same time, she explained to reporters. She is a certain kind of anti-fashion person, and that to me is something really chic and fashionable. At the coronation, Anna had a prominent role in the procession, accompanying King Charles as Colonel of the Blues and Royals in Royal Cavalry Regiment. The uniform was obligatory, but it allowed her, with a joke, for those excited when style choices were the subject of great curiosity. That is a role I was asked if I would like to do for the coronation, so I said yes. Not least of all, it solves my dress problem, she told the CBC. Stand out, essential, naturally chic, as when she carries her shoulder bags in her hands with a consummate model's posture. I've never been a city girl, she confided to Women's Day in an interview on her 70th birthday. It is said that if King Edward VIII had not abdicated, changing the line of succession to the heirs of George VI, Queen Elizabeth would have been a country girl who spent her time around horses. Same with Anne, who gave this opportunity to her daughter Zara by denying her the title of princess. Despite this, both the late monarch and the princess royal are recognized as style icons, albeit in their own way. Who knows? Perhaps Anne was the one who prompted that mother-daughter chat about fashion and style. Perhaps she was praised for her outfit, salvaged from who knows where, or for those wraparound glasses on an elegant ensemble. Even if that were the case, as reserved and modest as she is, she would never reveal it. Next up, Kate Middleton shares a summer surprise in a new video. The Princess of Wales is on vacation with her husband and children, but her social media feeds have a special message about the joy of connection and nature. This is by Javi Sanchez on August 14th. The Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton, has shared a new video of her series Mother Nature to her social media accounts. Although the princess does not appear in the video, she lends her voice to the narration and also nods to some of her activities in recent months with the presence of some of the dancers from the Royal Ballet School who participated in her Return to Work Christmas concert. Summer is a season for abundance. Just as the flowers bloom and the fruits ripen, we too are reminded of our potential for growth. It is the time to ignite our inner fire and explore our own creativity, passions, and dreams, she says in the video. As we bask in the sunlit hours, friends and families come together, playing, connecting, being present, embracing the joy to be found in even the most fleeting of moments and shared experiences. Our lives flourish when we cherish the bonds of love and friendship. So open your hearts, sing, dance, play. The days are still long, so simply love and be loved. In a caption, the princess also said that it has never been more important to appreciate the value of others and Mother Nature, and encouraged her followers to celebrate the season with her. Let's toast to summer. The video was launched on a surprising date as Kate, Prince William, and their three children are on vacation. It marks the second installment in a series titled Mother Nature, with the four seasons as its main motif. It was conceived by Kate as a way to share the connection and solace she found in the British countryside while coping with her cancer diagnosis. After the spring video, in which Kate appeared and said, "For the last year, nature has been my sanctuary," came the turn of summer. There are also nods to one of the hobbies she shares with Meghan Markle, beekeeping. According to a Kensington Palace statement that accompanied this installment, the series remains anchored in nature, but also captures human interactions and celebrates the joy of connecting, referring to the dancers, along with the sounds of families and children playing that accompany Kate's voice. Though the family is officially on vacation, Kate may have yet another summer surprise in store. She might make an appearance at the opening of the Women's Rugby World Cup, hosted by England on August 22nd. Moving to some American royalties, nothing rhymes with orange. Taylor Swift is already showing new tricks with the Life of a Showgirl album announcement. By beginning the rollout of her upcoming album on Travis Kelce's podcast, the singer has added a fresh page to her ever-expanding new release playbook. This is by Casey Wickman on August 12th. It's no surprise that Taylor Swift has a new album in the works. Did you really think the woman who released an entirely new double album in the middle of the biggest tour in history is at any point not working on new music? But the particulars of her first The Life of a Showgirl announcement show that Swift has some new tricks to offer. Never before has Swift involved another public figure, let alone a romantic partner, so heavily in the rollout of a project. Beau Travis Kelce, as well as Muppet-turned-man, a glowingly positive descriptor to be clear, Jason Kelce, will be forever linked with Swift's nascent showgirl era. The brothers sent the Swiftie-aligned world into a frenzy, first with the tease of a super special secret guest on an off-cycle episode of their podcast New Heights this Wednesday, and then revealed that of course it would be Swift. Then, at 12:12 a.m. Tuesday, disrespectful to my advancing age, but I digress, revealed the album's title. It is now available for a so-called pre-order. The listings on Swift's web store say the albums will ship by October 13th, while making it clear that that is not the official release date. There are six Fridays between now and then, but would Swift want to sneak the release in just before the eligibility deadline for the 2026 Grammys, or at the crack of 2027 Grammy dawn? The Kelce Brothers podcast, already popular with sports fans pre-Swift, broadened its audience significantly when Swift and Travis Kelce went public with their relationship in September 2023. In the 2 years since then, she's gone to a lot of his games, he's gone to a lot of her shows, they've eaten a lot of dinners, and he's even made an onstage cameo, scooping her off the ground in a tux and tails to segue into all-time depression bop, I Can Do It With a Broken Heart. Apart from the constant speculation that a just off-camera Swift is the cause of a twinkle in Travis's eye while recording the show, she's never appeared on New Heights as a guest or even as a cameo, as Jason's wife Kylie Kelce and their daughters have many times, whether audibly or visibly. The album itself is a new era. Finally, a use for all those unused orange beads in your bracelet-making kit, But so is this very public link between Swift and Kelce. Ex-partner Joe Alwyn co-wrote tracks with Swift on a few albums under the pseudonym William Bowery, but didn't publicly knit his image with her work like this. As the terminally online chroniclers of Swift's smudged red lipstick over the past few years will eagerly tell you, Swift and Kelce are no strangers to PDA. But this is a public display of association, unlike anything we've ever seen from Swift before. Of Swift's partners, Kelce is certainly the person most welcoming of publicity himself, but it's a big step to make him so permanent a feature of the album's lore. Of course, Swift being Swift, showgirl Easter eggs and clues already abound. Three squares with the TS logo treatment being used in early promotion are visible on the shelves behind Swift and Kelce in the New Heights video, each a different color. The Wednesday evening episode tease indicated she'll be revealing the album art on the show, so it feels like a non-zero chance that this signals special editions. There's also a newly released playlist on her Spotify account titled, "And Baby, That's Show Business for You." It features 22 of Swift's own tracks, beginning with Red's 22, all the songs of the compilation, which runs 1 hour and 22 minutes, are from Red, Reputation, and 1989, original flavors, not Taylor's version, with the exception of Message in the Bottle, which was a vault track only released on Red, Taylor's version. What does this mean? Well, for one thing, all of the included tracks were co-written or co-produced by Max Martin and Shellback, a Swedish producing duo, perhaps pretending a fresh collaboration between Swift and the team on Showgirl. If her 2024 original album, The Tortured Poets Department, was, by and large, a sad girl soundtrack, helmed by frequent Swift producers Jack Antonoff and Aaron Dessner, the return of Martin and Shellback hints at a pop rock-inflected sound for the new work. Then there's the prevalence of the number 2 in the rollout. Swift loves a good numerical hint, and this is no exception. Seeing double? Perhaps. I predicted a double album drop for the Tortured Poets Department and was right-ish, and I'll predict it again for Showgirl. Act 1 and Act 2, anyone? Swift is a maximalist in her musical output, as she is in her productions, and she's already said that the vault tracks for Reputation are finished. Since buying back her masters, there's not a whole lot of reason for Swift to re-release Rep TV. Why not release them as part of a second album, along with relics that didn't make her self-titled debut album? After all, if we're talking about the life of this showgirl, a return to where her stardom started would make sense. As for why those fresh trademark applications for the Life of a Showgirl and TLOAS filed by Swift's corporate arm this week are officially categorized in paperwork as being for candles, that remains a mystery. It's good to wonder, no? Let's move to the Hollywood section. Little Gold Men. Three cutthroat Emmy categories that could shake up the race. As Emmy voting kicks off Monday, several clear frontrunners have emerged, but a few underdogs might still shake things up. This is by Rebecca Ford on August 14th. Final Emmy voting kicks off on Monday. At this point in the race, there are usually several races that feel very competitive, but this year, many categories have obvious frontrunners, particularly Adolescence for limited series and Severance for drama series. Severance earned the most nominations of any show this year, with 27 total, and Adolescence is also a very beloved show with 13 nominations. But there's still some room for drama. As discussed on this week's episode of Little Gold Men, some of the acting races may be closer than they first appeared. The host also made picks for a few underdogs, Jeff Hiller for Somebody Somewhere, that they'd love to see get Emmy love. The truth is, you never know what's going to happen at the Emmys. Let's take a closer look at three of the races that could surprise us this year. Comedy series. It's the battle of the Hollywood set shows, with Hacks, the incumbent, up against the studio. HBO Max's Hacks had a very strong, critically acclaimed fourth season, earning 14 Emmy nominations, but it was also notably snubbed in categories like Supporting Actor, where Paul W. Downs and Carl Clemens Hopkins had both been nominated before. The studio earned more nominations, 23 in total, But it's worth noting that the series over-indexed in places like Guest Actor, where it took 5 of the category's 6 spots. The popular Apple TV Plus series nabbing all the acting nominations it was expected to get and will likely win in several categories. As a shiny new show, the studio has the edge to win the big category, but it's very likely Hacks could win in the writing category, where the shows are going up against each other once again. Most likely, neither show will go home empty-handed. Drama actress. The two frontrunners in this category have very different backstories. Kathy Bates is a beloved acting icon who, at 77, made history as the oldest performer ever nominated in this category. She's the sole nominee for her show, CBS's Matlock. It's rare for an acting nominee whose show has no other nominations to win here. The last time it happened was when orphan Black star Tatiana Maslany scored a win in 2016, according to Gold Derby. But Bates is also an Emmy darling. She most recently nominated in 2015 and 2016 for American Horror Story Freak Show and American Horror Story Hotel, respectively. And she's won 2 Emmys before, for a guest appearance on 2.5 Men, and a supporting actress win for American Horror Story, Coven. On the other end of the scale is Britt Lower, a first-time Emmy nominee for her work on the second season of Severance. Her show comes in with the most nominations of any series this year, which speaks to the TV Academy's support for Severance. But Lower is a rising star with plenty more time to win Emmys, while Bates is an icon, and many might feel she is due another big moment. There's a possibility that Severance could miss out in every acting category, especially if Lower loses to Bates. Adam Scott is up against The Pitt's Noah Wiley, who is considered the best bet for his show to win an award. And though Trammell Tillman, John Turturro, and Zach Cherry are nominated for supporting actor, they're all competing against Walton Goggins for his show-stopping White Lotus performance. Next up is comedy guest acting. The comedy guest actor categories are star-studded this year and contain some of the season's tightest races. Hacks, Poker Face, and The Bear have each won guest actress in a comedy series recently and all have strong contenders again this year. Cynthia Erivo is nominated for playing 5 identical sisters on Poker Face and was in the spotlight this past year thanks to Wicked and the upcoming Wicked for Good. Julianne Nicholson is nominated for playing the insane dance mom on Hacks, and she's a rare double nominee this year. She's also up for drama supporting actress for Paradise, and last year's winner in this category, Jamie Lee Curtis, is once again nominated for The Bear. Any of these 3 actresses could win here, so the final result is a real coin toss. As previously mentioned, guest actor in a comedy features 5 actors from the studio: Bryan Cranston, Martin Scorsese, Dave Franco, Ron Howard, and Anthony Mackie. And there's also the Bear's John Bernthal, who won this category last year. Bernthal is an actor's actor and could win again even though his show didn't earn as much love this season as it has in the past. But because the studio has been such a hit with voters, the award is more likely to go to one of its contenders. Which one will the voters pick? Cranston is the only man here not appearing as a heightened version of himself. He plays a Robert Evans-esque studio overlord, which gives him a leg up. But it's also possible that voters would love to see Scorsese win an acting Emmy and pick him solely for that reason. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently reading from vanityfair.com. We're in the Hollywood section, and we're on to our next article called Denzel to Spike. Denzel Washington and Spike Lee on streaming, retirement, and their decades-long bond. This is by David Canfield on August 14th. There are a few reasons why Denzel Washington asked Spike Lee to direct Highest to Lowest, a vivid reimagining of the 1963 Akira Kurosawa film High and Low. The first, and perhaps deepest, has to do with the nature of the project and what it would represent for these longtime Oscar-winning collaborators. In most of the time I've been an actor, I wouldn't even have been allowed to play a part like this. No white directors were hiring us and no studios were hiring us. We could be a slave. We could be a friend. We could be the buddy. I've seen it all in the 50 years I've been at it, and that's why I called Spike, Washington says. I've never heard from certain other filmmakers. Well, let me not go down that road, but that's why I called Spike. I trust Spike and he trusts me. Washington is sitting beside Lee for a wide-ranging interview about their latest movie, which hits theaters on August 15th via A24, before streaming on Apple TV Plus on September 5th. The pair are a journalist's nightmare and a movie lover's dream. It's rare for one to get through an answer without being interrupted by the other. They laugh together in ways that indicate their deep history and friendship, having too much fun to get especially in-depth. For any fan of their incredible cinematic legacy, it's hard not to be moved or really entertained by it. That's especially true given the subject matter of Highest to Lowest. The film stars Washington as David King, a trailblazing music label executive considering the sale of his company as he faces changing times and with them changing tastes. He's jolted into a different kind of action when his son is targeted in a kidnapping plot by an aspiring rapper, played by A$AP Rocky. The son of David's longtime friend and chauffeur, Paul, played by Jeffrey Wright, is taken by mistake, leaving David with the dilemma of whether and how to pay the ransom. His odyssey reintroduces David to his old New York neighborhood and roots, as well as the initial artistic spark that slowly flamed out as he made his millions. The movie crackles with the restless energy of its city and the singular, enduring creativity of its director and star. Its last line, "Let's go to work," sounds deceptively simple, but speaks to Highest to Lowest's rich autobiographical undertones and what it meant for Washington and Lee to reunite for their first movie in more than 15 years. It also happens to be one of the last lines in Lee's all-time favorite movie, On the Waterfront. The director wanted to pay homage, but the choice also went deeper. It was not random. It's because work is what we do. If I may speak for Denzel right here, we love what we do, Lee says. When you have an occupation that you love, you're blessed, because the majority of people on this earth go to their grave having hated their job. Washington chimes in, "It's to have the luxury to like it or not like it." This pumps Lee up. "There you go. Come on now. Come on, Dee." Lee first worked with Washington on 1990's Mo Better Blues. That movie was shot in a few months before the release of Glory, the Civil War drama that would catapult Washington to movie stardom and win him his first Oscar. "I'm a better filmmaker now than I was with Mo Better Blues," Lee says. "Every time I've done a film with Denzel, I've learned. The brilliant actor he is has lifted up my directing because I'm going to hear it from him if I'm not bringing it. I don't want my brother to get my ass slapped. Can't do that. That's a standard we have." Together, they've made a masterpiece in Malcolm X, a box office smash in Inside Man, and now their most personal undertaking yet. As a professor at New York University, Lee teaches at least one of his movies starring Washington every semester. Sometimes it's Malcolm X, fall, and spring semester. Next month, Washington will actually join the director on campus. "I've agreed to come to class," the actor says. "Where are we at? What month is it?" "Beginning of September," Lee replies, "on a Thursday." They go back and forth about the timing before Lee says, "I'm looking forward to the questions my intelligent students at NYU Film School will have for Mr. Washington." All of their projects live inside them, a specific kind of language they can't always explain. While discussing the cast of Highest to Lowest, decorated actors like Wendell Pierce, John Douglas Thompson, and Michael Potts, also among them, Washington says, "Teamwork makes the dream work." "Where's that from?" Lee asks knowingly. "I don't know," Washington says. "He got game. You had the kid out doing laps till 4 a.m. in the morning. You knocked him down. He got mad. He threw a ball." "That's right," Washington says, recalling their acclaimed sports movie. "I haven't seen that movie since." As in nonsense 1998? "I don't watch them. Once I make them, I'm done with them." Washington does not remember how Highest to Lowest got to him in the first place. "I had never seen High and Low," he says. "Still haven't. But he knew the script by Alan Fox seemed like a natural fit for Lee. Out of nowhere, my brother called me and said, 'I've got this project. I want to send it.' I said, what? Lee says. They hadn't yet realized it'd been so long since their last movie, 2006's Inside Man. Once they got to work, it was like no time had passed. What kinds of conversations did they have about the movie before production started? Here's the other reason I called Spike. So we wouldn't have to do any of those, Washington says. He knows what he's doing. I know what I'm doing. Lee approached Highest to Lowest as anything but a remake. I took this as a jazz reinterpretation of a great film, he says. I knew if I was to do this, it had to be a reimagining, and it was right up my alley, a big, fat, juicy one coming down the middle of the plate, and I feel like I knocked it out. Highest to Lowest debuted to a strong reviews at Cannes Film Festival. At the premiere's official press conference, Lee said that he expected this to be the final movie he made with Washington, given that the actor had been publicly discussing retirement. Lee has since walked that comic back. I have to stop saying it, Lee says. I hope it'll happen again. I pose the question to Washington next, since he has considered retiring in the past. And the actor responds by quoting what appears to be a lengthy passage, verbatim, from Matt Chandler's 2012 book, The Explicit Gospel, sent to Washington by my guy Sal. No matter what our job is, we view it not as our purpose in life, but rather as where God has sovereignly placed us for the purpose of making Christ known and his name great. If you are a teacher, if you are a politician, if you are a businessman, if you are in agriculture, if you are in construction, if you're in technology, if you are in the arts, then you should not be saying, I need to find my life's purpose in this work, but rather, I need to bring God's purpose to this work. Meaning, I no longer use the word retirement, Washington says. I'm looking for opportunities to bring God's purpose to my work. That's where I'm at. And then he reads the passage aloud in full again. In Cannes, Highest to Lowest played like gangbusters in a packed theater. Audiences were particularly glued to a riveting train sequence at the movie's midpoint and the climactic tete-a-tete between Washington and Rocky's characters. This movie is made for the big screen, and Lee and Washington want to make that very clear in this interview. No matter how big that TV on your wall in your home is, see it in theaters first, Lee says. By my count, they mention its August 15th theatrical release date 5 different times. In the theaters, in the theaters, in the theaters, Washington says at one point. I'll keep saying August 15th, but Highest to Lowest will only get a limited rollout on the big screen before going to streaming, given that their latest movie made north of $186 million at the global box office. Are they disappointed with how Highest to Lowest is getting distributed? That's the nature of the business now. They also gave us a lot of money to make the film, Washington says. The industry has changed. Time has changed. So we got to change with the times, Lee adds. This film would not have been made without Apple. That's just the truth. We'd done this 4 times already, and the last time was a great box office success, Lee continues. Not to say that all that success is built upon box office, but it is called show business, Washington interjects. No business, no show. No business, no next show. Lee laughs. That's true. We understand the ramifications of this business. This brings Washington back to the shorthand between them and why he brought his old friend along for this film. It's trust, he says. There was only one person to do this, and I'm sitting next to him. Next up is a first look. Nobody Wants This is going deeper, but staying light in season 2. Jenny Connor and Aaron Foster open up about the Netflix rom-com's return and the criticism it got in season 1. To have a sweet, happy show that reminds people how beautiful Judaism is. Take the win, you know? This is by Joy Press on August 14th. From the moment it premiered last fall, Nobody Wants This felt like the platonic ideal of a millennial rom-com. It brought together the OC's Adam Brody and Veronica Mars star Kristen Bell for a hot rabbi shiksa podcaster meet-cute. Meshuggah ensued as Rabbi Noah and Joanne tried to figure out how to integrate their very different Los Angeles lifestyles and families. The series, loosely sparked by creator Aaron Foster's own interfaith romance and conversion to Judaism, was a hit for Netflix. It also inspired a steady stream of TikToks, from besotted odes to crying to reenactments. I'm not going to lie. I was watching all the TikToks, Foster says. I kind of wanted to see how the show resonated with people, to strike a balance between giving people the things that they liked, but not letting that dictate every decision that we made. There were some specific stories she wanted to tell in the first season, like Joanne getting the ick from Noah's sweet attempts to make a good impression on her family. That was really important to me, to watch her kind of self-sabotage and see him refuse to let her do that, Foster says. I really loved watching TikToks of women saying that this show was about making healthy love fun and exciting and sexy. Season 2, which drops October 23rd, squarely between Rosh Hashanah and Hanukkah, focuses on the critical months after the initial chemical reaction, when a romantic relationship gets real. How much time are you going to spend together? Do you like each other's friends? Can you merge your families? For agnostic Joanne and devout Noah, the big will they or won't they is, will Joanne convert? And if she doesn't, will Noah be able to keep his place within the temple? Beyond Joanne and Noah, Season 2 also offers the chance to dig deeper into standout characters, like Joanne's sister Morgan, played by Justine Lupe, Noah's brother Sasha, played by Timothy Simons, and his wife Esther, played by Jackie Tone, who appeared to be edging toward a low-key love triangle last time around. Two venerable girls alumni, Jenny Connor and Bruce Eric Kaplan, joined Nobody Wants This in Season 2 as showrunners. No one is trying to reinvent anything, Connor says reassuringly. We're not going to shoot in black and white this year or do a musical. They both came in as fans. As Kaplan told Vanity Fair last year, I love the heroine in that she's imperfect but amazing. And I love watching this other person celebrate her exactly as she is. It doesn't hurt that Connor and Kaplan are both Jewish, since Season 1 drew some sharp criticism of its Jewish female characters. I was honestly very surprised, and I was disappointed, Foster says, of the criticism. Find me another Jewish rom-com showing Jewish people in such a positive light, showing the Jewish faith in such a positive light. It's something that I take very seriously as someone who converted and felt so welcomed by the Jewish community. She continues, with the heaviness of what's going on in the world around the Jewish faith, to have a lighthearted, sweet, happy show that reminds people how beautiful Judaism is. Don't find something wrong with it. Take the win, you know? Connor mentioned that while the team brought in Rabbi Sharon Brouse to talk to the writers, they didn't script anything this season specifically in response to the criticism. They didn't, like any show, the second season is when you really start to develop your characters, Connor says. So we develop Esther more and show why she behaves that way and see her other sides, including the parts of her personality that made Sasha fall in love with her in the first place. Meanwhile, Nova's mother, Bina, played by Tova Feldsha, remains intimidating, but in a way that doesn't make her the punchline or the patsy. I'm not going to say she's warm and fuzzy all of a sudden because she's playing the foil to our main character. She has to be rough, Connor says, but I do think we start to understand why she is the way she is. Bina even makes an emotional connection with wild child Morgan, who could learn a thing or two from Bina. Morgan's character is a big, big, big part of the season, Foster tells me. She really explores some stuff in the wake of her sister being in this healthy relationship. Naturally competitive, Morgan attempts to top Joanne's rabbi boyfriend by bringing home psychotherapist Dr. Andy, Lupe's fellow succession graduate, Arian Moyad. All of this might just destabilize the sexy confessional podcast that Joanne and Morgan co-host. They start having conflict, Connor promises, and not the fun kind. Just as girls carved out a space for women to be screw-ups, Nobody Wants This allows the sisters to be who they are in all their mess. Moyad is one of several new casting gems this season. Another is girls MVP Alex Karpovsky as a rival rabbi at Noah's synagogue. The guest star most likely to thrill Nobody Wants This fans, though, is Gossip Girl's Leighton Meester, who also happens to be married to Brody in real life. She plays a school frenemy of Joanne's, who is now a momfluencer. The role wasn't created for Meester, but when her name was floated, the writers expanded the part and crafted a scene that throws Meester and Brody together. I did not anticipate how funny she would be, Connor says. She's really good at improv. Everything she feels really weird and you don't see it coming, and seeing her and Adam in a scene together was so much fun. Connor says that Foster is an incredible advocate for her characters because she knows them inside and out. Some of my favorite moments on set are watching Aaron and Kristen whisper to each other, and I'm like, is this Joanne and Joanne, or is it Aaron and Aaron? Kristen works so hard to give Joanne the respect she deserves and to bring that voice to the screen. Ultimately, the heart of season two remains Joanne and Noah. I would say that Joanne's journey is figuring out how to be in a healthy relationship and what that looks like, because I think that she romanticizes the idea in a lot of ways, Foster says. I think that Noah's arc, we have to avoid saying that in a lot in the writer's room, is, am I chasing this because it's exciting and different, or is this really my lifelong partner? Foster says she and her sisters and friends used to talk about choosing between the safe person and the exciting person. It turns out there was this third option, someone who was exciting and exhilarating and also loving and stable. If I was able to find that at 37, then I want other women to also know that they should be waiting for that. She smiles, and he does not have to be a rabbi. Our next headline, David Ellison lays out his Paramount plans and puts politics at arm's length. On his first day on the job, the 42-year-old CEO squared off at the company's Midtown HQ with a gaggle of reporters who pressed him on his vision for the media juggernaut and, of course, Donald Trump. This is by Natalie Korak. It was back on August 7th, but I didn't have time for it last week. Just a few paces from the Sherry Redstone studio in the Paramount building near Times Square, newly minted CEO David Ellison, flanked by members of his executive team, met the press for the first time since wrapping up Skydance's $8 billion merger with the legacy media giant. Immediately, Ellison found himself in the hot seat when Fox Business Network's Charlie Gasparino asked him to address Donald Trump's claim that he'd made a side deal with the new owners that would include airing $20 million worth of ads, public service announcements, or similar programming as part of a settlement to resolve the president's lawsuit against CBS over the editing of a 60 Minutes interview. We were not involved in the settlement in any way, Ellison replied, adding that Skydance complied with all laws, including the anti-bribery law. That answer wasn't going to cut it for the slew of media reporters in the room, one of whom asked whether the company has a deal with Trump to provide free airtime. We are not going to politicize anything today, Ellison said in response. Given that this was the first opportunity to pepper Ellison, 42, with questions, it seemed like the entire media reporting corps trekked midday Thursday to Paramount's Midtown headquarters for a private luncheon. Kara Swisher, Ben Smith were on hand, along with Brian Stelter, Oliver Darcy, Peter Kafka, Sarah Fisher, Ben Mullen, Lachlan Cartwright, Stephen Battling Battaglio, and more. Perched on high top tables, journalists probed Ellison and his executive team for more than 30 minutes on business and politics and where the two collide. That's unavoidable given the circumstances surrounding the acquisition, which was approved by the FCC in July after Paramount settled Trump's defamation lawsuit for $16 million. Congressional leaders, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, have raised concerns about Trump's alleged deal with Skydance. Paramount has denied the accusations. Following the settlement, CBS canceled The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, citing financial reasons. Further drama ensued in July, just one day after Paramount announced the deal with the creators of South Park for $1.5 billion, when the animated show kicked off its 27th season by mocking both Paramount and Trump. When Vanity Fair asked Ellison whether he watched Wednesday's episode of South Park, which once again skewed the Trump administration by mocking Vice President J.D. Vance and Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, as well as the president, he said that he hadn't had a chance to yet, given that the episodes came out a day later on the Paramount Plus streaming platform. He added that he plans to watch the episode this evening after he finishes making the rounds on Deal Day. Asked whether he was concerned about the Trump administration taking issue with the show's content, Ellison argued that the creators are equal opportunity offenders. In taking control of Paramount, Ellison has said he intends to find more than $2 billion in cost-cutting measures. Lightshed partners Rich Greenfield, who's been a media analyst for over two decades, told Vanity Fair prior to Thursday's lunch that he thinks there's a lot of cost-cutting still to go on the linear TV side of the business, but that on the streaming and studio side, they need investment, not cutting. Greenfield added that if Paramount aspires to become a long-term streaming winner, it has a responsibility to invest heavily in the company. At lunch, in response to a question about how the company plans to implement the cuts, Jeff Shell, who will serve as the president, said, We don't believe, and I think this is true of all five of us, that we would cut our way to growth. In this business, you have to invest. Ellison argued Paramount needs to be the most technical media company out there. Clearly, he has an advantage on this front, as his father, Larry Ellison, is the co-founder of the software company Oracle and worth more than $300 billion. Ellison has consistently emphasized his understanding of the technology ecosystem, once touting his family's close relationship with Steve Jobs and the early advice Jobs gave him on Skydance on Swisher's Sway podcast. Ellison has significant experience within film and TV production, with Skydance being involved with the Mission Impossible franchise, Top Gun Maverick, Jack Ryan, and more. However, the newly minted chairman and CEO of Paramount, a Skydance corporation, has never run a company as large as the conglomerate that reportedly has around 18,000 staffers. Meanwhile, over at CBS News, some staffers are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. Ellison made an appearance for Thursday's morning editorial meeting shortly after the merger was made official, where he reportedly reassured staffers of his dedication to the legacy of CBS News. Ellison mentioned his newsroom appearance while answering questions at the luncheon, adding that his visits to CBS News and 60 Minutes specifically hopefully speaks to how important a part of the organization I believe they are. Jerry Cardinale, founder and managing partner of Redbird Capital, a major backer of the merger, added that it would simply be bad business to attempt to influence the output of a news organization. The kernel of the entire investment thesis is independence and objectivity. If you can't get your head around that, don't buy it, he said. Once one CBS News insider tells me that internally, many people quietly feel good. After over a year of uncertainty and financial strains, people are ready for a fresh start and change and want CBS News to succeed, the source added. While mingling after the Q&A session, I asked Ellison about trust in news in these polarized times. Half of my family is Democrat, half my family is Republican, he adding, I don't intend to put my finger on the scale. Shortly thereafter, Melissa Zuckerman, who was recently appointed as Chief Communications Officer, told me and Oliver Darcy, no more PSA questions, insinuating the team was exhausted by the queries, taking Ellison away from the two of us to make his way around the room. We're going to end with just a little bit of politics. The U.S.-Russia summit. Trump, Zelensky to meet at White House after no deal with Putin at U.S.-Russia summit. The U.S. president dropped the ceasefire demand for Ukraine after meeting with the Russian leader in Alaska. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on August 16th. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is headed to the White House on Monday after being left out of President Donald Trump's nearly three-hour meeting with Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, in Alaska on Friday. Trump and Putin met to discuss a potential ceasefire deal in Ukraine, but left without such an agreement. The U.S.-Russian summit in Anchorage between the two leaders featured Trump rolling out a literal red carpet welcome for Putin, clapping as he arrived, and taking several friendly photo ops together, a contrast from other world leaders who are more icy with the Russian head of state. Putin accepted Trump's invitation to ride in the back of the armored presidential Cadillac limousine known as the Beast from the tarmac at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson to the meeting location before sitting down with aides for both men. Trump brought Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff into the room with him. Trump has already changed course from the plan he previously said he would pursue to apply pressure to Putin to end his offensive in Ukraine. Following the meeting, as the New York Times reports, Trump on Saturday split from Ukraine and key European allies after his summit and is now backing Mr. Putin's plan for a sweeping peace agreement based on Ukraine ceding territory it controls to Russia, instead of the urgent ceasefire Mr. Trump had said he wanted before the meeting. Much of Europe quickly moved to back Ukraine following Trump's post-summit strategy shift. Though the Times explained, the leaders treaded carefully to not openly contradict Mr. Trump as he aligned himself with Russia's vision of ending the war. As the Associated Press reported on late Friday, the U.S. president has offered Putin both a carrot and a stick, issuing threats of punishing economic sanctions on Russia, while also extending a warm welcome at the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. But he appeared to walk away without any concrete progress on ending the war in Ukraine, now in its fourth year. Since the onset of the war, according to the reporting from The Times in June, nearly 1 million Russian troops have been killed or wounded, and close to 400,000 Ukrainian troops have also been killed or wounded. Following Putin and Trump's meeting, the U.S. president posted on his social media platform, Truth Social, about the summit, calling it a, quote, great and very successful day in Alaska. Trump wrote that he had spoken with Zelensky and other European leaders and claimed that it was determined by all that the best way to end the horrific war between Russia and Ukraine is to go directly to a peace agreement, which would end the war, and not a mere ceasefire agreement, which oftentimes do not hold up. Zelensky confirmed the meeting on X, writing, "I am grateful for the invitation. In my conversation with President Trump, I said that sanctions should be strengthened if there is no trilateral meeting or if Russia tries to evade an honest end to the war," the Ukrainian leader wrote in a subsequent post a few hours later. "Sanctions are an effective tool. Security must be guaranteed reliably and in the long term with the involvement of both Europe and the U.S. All issues important to Ukraine must be discussed with Ukraine's participation, and no issue, particularly territorial ones, can be decided without Ukraine." It'll be Zelensky's first time back in the White House since he, Trump, and Vice President J.D. Vance publicly clashed in a heated interaction in late February. During that meeting, Vance called Zelensky disrespectful and accused him of not being thankful enough to Trump, who told the Ukrainian leader that he wasn't being enough of a tough guy. Prior to the summit, Trump had held that he would walk out on any conversation with the Russian president if he didn't feel Putin was serious about reaching peace. On Air Force One, on the way home, Trump told Fox News that it was now up to President Zelensky to get it done. Immediately following the talks in Alaska, Putin and Trump stood side by side and gave brief, vague remarks after canceling a planned press conference. "There were many, many points that we agree on," Trump said, adding, "a couple of big ones that we haven't quite gotten there." "So," he continued, "there's no deal until there's a deal." Putin spoke positively of Trump, even echoing his claim that the war in Ukraine wouldn't exist if he had been elected in 2020 instead of former President Joe Biden. "Today we hear President Trump say, 'If I were president, there would be no war,'" Putin said. "I think that would actually happen. I confirm this. I think that overall, me and President Trump have built a very good businesslike and trustworthy contact, he said. Trump ended by telling Putin, "We'll speak to you very soon and probably see you again very soon." "Next time in Moscow," Putin, smiling, replied in English. Trump said that he might get a little heat on that one, but that he could possibly see it happening. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I invite you to join me next week. We'll have another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thank you for listening, and have a great week, everybody.